A lot of people will tell you within the community of adoptees, you know, our life doesn't start the day we were adopted. There's this whole other time and space and family that existed prior.
Society in general, they don't really understand the implications of adoption. They just feel, well, you were adopted, problem solved.
I knew I couldn't stay where I was or keep living with that grief. So moving through it was the only option.
I know in African culture, that's extremely important that you're able to put yourself into, they call it, the flow of time. And it feels like that my lineage has been cut with my adoption.
There's such value in being in community among other adoptees, and it was validating for me. So that really helped for me to get connected, and then seems as if the world just opened up.
If I'm the secret that everybody has held for 37 years, you know, who can I talk to? And finally, it just hit me. I have a choice here. You're affected from the moment it happens. You're impacted. But I needed to know that I was going to be able to come to an understanding and a reconciliation.
You may have wondered what reunion looks like from an adoptee's point of view, or be embarking upon taking that journey yourself to search for your first family, or simply want confirmation that you are not alone in your experience. It's Jennifer Diane Gostin, and welcome to Once Upon a Time in Adoptee Land. Wouldn't it be empowering to have many of your burning questions answered here? I welcome my guest this week back for a second time. When he was here before, we discussed his relinquishment and adoption journey, sprinkled with his appreciation for the valuable resource in our community of adoptee-related podcasts. On this occasion, we explore what deeply unpacking some of his experiences over the last few years have meant to him. His name is Michael Knox. Our fellowship started in 2021, and we have kept in touch since then. During this episode, Michael opens up about his addiction to alcohol, 25 years of sobriety, and a relapse during the initial phases of being in reunion with his biological family. He is transparent and hopes to offer inspiration about what has led to his recovery for nearly a year now. In hindsight, David would have entered reunion a bit differently and takes responsibility for allowing the deep dive into the adoption community to overwhelm him at times. Without further delay, allow me to introduce to you again, or for the first time, a person who doesn't shy away from sharing his experiences in adoption land. He credits hearing other adoptees speak their truth as being of a tremendous value to him and desires to pay it forward about what he's come to understand about the journey of reunion with biological family. As a doting grandfather, watching the beautiful little people in his family grow up, unsettling feelings have arisen about what happened or did not happen to him when he was a baby. I can certainly relate to that. Michael, I am so excited for you to return to the podcast. So I thank you so much for accepting the invitation. And let's just start with, how are you doing in Atlanta?
Thanks for asking, and thanks for having me back. I'm doing really good, much better. It's been a rocky road for the last 3 and 4 years since I, you know, connected with my biological family. I had no idea how it would change my life and change how I think. And it's been very interesting. I think I'm coming out the other end. And the reason I wanted to come back was to be able to share all the things I went through, so that if people are searching now, they may not have the same reactions, but at least some of the things I found out that, you know, disturbed me, changed my life, you know, they know it might be coming their way if they, you know, are searching it and find their family. Yeah, that's why I'm back.
Yeah, and I am pretty sure that there will be at least one listener, probably more than one, that will be able to receive some guidance from what you have to share, because a reunion can be very tricky, and sometimes we don't hear about that, like a revisit, which was kind of my mood at the beginning of 2024, to kind of reflect and revisit with guests that have things to say, kind of like to, I guess it would be an update, but more like what they've learned. And like you say, over 3-4 years, I'm sure, have a lot you've learned, and just your willingness to share it means a lot. So thank you for that.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure. So I share with everyone.
Yeah. Well, when you were here before, which was December 28th, your episode aired of 2021, we covered a lot. You shared quite a bit. What's popping up is that Iron Man, like 5 times you did Iron Man. And you talked about also how you grew up. You're born in Chicago and then moved to California, and then right in the mid-90s, relocated to Atlanta. So you shared quite a bit, and I encourage any listeners to go back and listen to that episode. And like you said, you're really here today to give us a picture of how things went, because you didn't talk much about your paternal reunion. Wherever you want to start and however much you want to share, that'd be great.
Oh, appreciate it. Yeah, you know, I said it before, but I really didn't care about being adopted. It was never in my wheelhouse. I never thought about it. But then I start listening to podcasts and hearing all the stories, and I start getting concerned. Now, I don't know if it was concerned or worried or upset at some of the stuff that was going on in the adoption community. I didn't know how to deal with it. Now, let me say, I was 25 years sober. I had, you know, quit drinking early 30s. And back then I was smoking, I was doing drugs, I was drinking a ton. And I just stopped, you know, 25 years ago. And the information that was coming to me so rapidly from all directions, on the father side, the mother side, from the podcast, I just didn't know what to do. And sure enough, I picked up a drink. I just started going deeper into a hole of drinking. And what people say, you know, if you're an alcoholic like I am, and I have no problem saying that, even though you stopped for 25 years, you pick up right where you were and even worse. And that's exactly what happened.
Let me ask you this. I'm sorry. And I really appreciate you being so vulnerable here, because I'm sure it's going to be helpful to the audience to understand like the magnitude of this whole reunion piece, right? When did you pick up the drink after being sober 25 years?
It would only have been a few months into it.
Into
it
reunion.
Wasn't very long. And I will preface it that every time I found a piece, everybody was very nice. It wasn't like I was dealing with rejection from the family. Everybody wanted to know who I was, you know, actually visit everybody. They were very nice, but it was just so overwhelming.
Right.
I couldn't deal with it. I just didn't know what to do. And my kids didn't know I was drinking. My wife didn't know I was drinking. I was hiding it from everyone. So I would listen to a podcast and somebody else would come on and say something. And I'd shake my head and get upset. And of course, you know, then there I am grabbing a drink, you know, just to numb myself from all this information. People started talking all the time about coming out of the fog, which you'll hear on a whole ton of the podcasts, that coming out of the fog. And I didn't know what that meant. And a lot of people couldn't have the perfect definition of it. And neither do I. But what I do know is that it was probably all the things I learned listening to the podcasts, that if you really wanted to go down the rabbit hole, and all the things that adoption is in America, and it's where America imports from all over the world to do adoption, some of the things start to really bug you. And it's bugging me because it happened to me. These are the things that were really getting to me at the time, was this whole idea of when the baby is born, and my daughter and my daughter-in-law both have my first two grandchildren, and they spent, you know, it was 2 hours after the baby was born before we could see them, and we didn't know what was going on. well, they call it that skin on skin time. I said, wow. And I had heard in all these podcasts, you know, the birth mothers never even get to see the babies. And it was like, that's a problem. I'm not holding anyone under the flame or blaming them, but they didn't know back then. I mean, even when I had my kids, which are 35, older than that, my youngest is 30 years old. And it was maybe 10 minutes of that skin on skin time. We didn't even know back then. So now, you know, you start to hear about how you were never held by your mother. And, you know, that's important because that's that bonding. And you can even watch videos of babies that are just born and they're crying and crying and crying. And the minute they're set on their mom's chest, they stop crying. When you see that and you're an adopted person, you go, what happened to me?
Yeah, it sounds like it was, when you use the word bugging, it sounds like it was activating or triggering something, this subject of skin on skin time.
Yes, I think it was more, I didn't understand it. I am sober now about 11 months. You know, I'm doing a 12-step program and I stopped drinking. And, you know, that's why I'm probably doing this now. I was in no shape to be doing it while I was drinking. So that helps. It helps a lot.
Congratulations. Yes.
Thank you. Yeah. It feels great. You know, it allows me to look at these things with a more critical eye. The one thing that was really amazing was my son and daughter-in-law had my granddaughter, you know, about 6-7 months ago. And I remember picking her up and going, the baby, and picking her up, going in her bedroom and sitting in a chair and holding her for an hour and a half when she was only a couple of months old. And she fell asleep in my arms. And the whole time I was there, I realized this never happened for me.
Right.
You know, I didn't have a grandfather or a mother or a father or anybody to sit down and hold me, you know, like that, you know, that was part of my biological family. The whole thing was rejected right from the get-go. Her father said, you can either have an abortion or you can give the baby up for adoption. And she made the choice. So holding Everly, my granddaughter, definitely helped me go, okay, this is what I was missing. And it's important. I realized how important it was because I was doing it. And then the other thing, and again, I'm going to credit podcasts all for most of this stuff, finding all this out, was I was adopted through the Cradle Society, which Jennifer knows about because it's up in Chicago.
But I sure do.
Yeah, I was in there for 2 months before I was actually released to my adopted parents. I have no idea why. You know, I know my sister was adopted from there, you know, the one that I grew up with, and she was only there for 2 days, and you just can't find out, you know. And so, like, who was holding me? You know, what was going on? You know, I've heard over the years now of listening to podcasts that back in those days, they would, you know, give the babies a little bit of drugs to quiet them down. Did they do that for me? You know, who knows? It's one of those things the first couple of months of life that a lot of us adoptees don't know what happened to us, you know, and who held us and whatnot. So that bothered me. Did it change me? I don't know, but it bothered me when I heard it. And of course, it did change me because I was drinking over the stuff. And so it was those kind of things that just kept crashing up against me. I kept hearing it and it's just like, wow. And I just didn't know how to deal with it. So then it got into the whole idea of, and boy, you hear it on a lot of different things about how I was sold. That's a bad thing to say, but it was, in my mind, it was absolutely true. Now you talk to the Cradle and they will say, oh, no, we don't charge. We would like a donation. Okay, fine. Because I actually asked them about it. I had a phone call with a few questions to them. And I was like, okay, I know that my grandmother, I'm sure, gave quite a large donation for both of us. You know, I can't be sure of that. I don't know. Yeah, it was like, okay, I served a purpose for my grandmother. That was the thing that really bothered me, you know, that I was purchased so my grandmother could hand down legacy, you know, in her family. And there's something about it that really bugged me. And so, of course, I'm, drinking and getting madder about those kind of things. And then I start listening to some of the stories that are quite interesting about these adoptions agencies and people talking, even now, a couple of them that are very focused on this idea of that babies can be brought across state lines. You know, you could take one from Iowa and bring it to Illinois to the Cradle Society or whatever society. I don't want to beat on the Cradle Society, but there's no, if you bring anything across a border, it's interstate commerce. Well, they're selling a baby, but there's absolutely no regulations to that. You can take a baby anywhere you want, and nobody cares about that in the government. And as people say, it's a multi-million dollar business of adopting babies, selling them and the adoption thing. Yes, that part of this whole thing bothers me to no end. I really appreciate sometimes I'll hear a podcast where people are being interviewed that are not selling them. They are, they're truly a charity organization that's doing the best for the baby, finding the right parents for them. That's reassuring that some of them are doing that, but boy, oh boy, they're still out there. I mean, the Cradle's still in business today. I'm 63 now, and I think they were doing it for 20 years before that, easy. So I don't know how long they've been around, as far as that's concerned.
I hear you saying that the birth mother not touching or seeing you and the what happened in those 2 months you were at the Cradle, and then the whole idea of an adoptee being sold and considered a product really got under your skin. I would imagine there was maybe profound sadness about all of that. And that's what led you to seek relief, right? Like,
yes.
Yeah. Yes. Like you needed relief. Yeah.
Yeah. I wanted to be numb. It was both anger and sadness. I guess it was grief. Over and over again, you would hear on almost, I've heard it on your podcast, everyone says, well, I got a therapist, I got an adoption competent therapist. Well, it took me 3 and a half years before I said, you know what, I'm throwing in the towel. And I went and saw a therapist, as far as that's concerned. And I'll get to that in a second. But one of the things that I heard once, and I actually looked into this, and boy, I'll tell you right now, this is really shows you where the adoption agency is about the money and not the best well-being for the baby, what's best for him. Because somebody likes to do this on one of the podcasts and compare it to, what people go through to do pet adoptions. So in almost, all the states, in America, there are laws that saying you cannot take a puppy away from its mother to sell it. It has to be at least 8 weeks old. Do they do that for babies? For human beings? No. It's so ironic that they have stronger laws for pet adoption than they do for babies. Right. When a human baby,
yeah.
Me.
Exactly.
And then the research shows that if these puppies, this is so great because it's true. The one thing is listening to all the podcasts and listening to other adoptees, they said, yep, that's how I feel. Yep, I did that my whole life. Yes, I did that. We all have these certain things. And it shows, if you read this, you can pull it up on the internet real easy. It shows that puppies separated too early are more likely to show fear, aggression, anxiety, reactivity, inappropriate play with other puppies. Now, gee, have I heard that somewhere before? Something like, the statement of adoptees are 3 times more likely to commit suicide or substance abuse or be in jail. Now, I'll be fair about that. I haven't researched that myself, but boy, I have heard it over and over and over again on podcasts. Those are very disturbing facts. Should I have been in jail? Yes. Do I abuse substances? Yes. I was all of that. I never had the idea of committing suicide. But as one person said, it's not like I fear the thought. Some people say they never, ever thought about it. Well, I think about it. It's not that I want to do it, but it doesn't bother me to think about it. What if I drove off this cliff? Oh, well, I have no desire to do that. But I mean, that's kind of disturbing when you have those kind of numbers and nobody wants to talk about it in the adoption community or in the, you know, the profession of the agencies and whatnot. And one of the things that I heard that really became relevant was I heard the word over and over again about bonding, you know, that you have a problem bonding with people. And I said, yes, for me, that is absolutely true. It was a word I'd never heard, never did. I had a job that I absolutely loved. I started when there was only three people. It was 250 people when I, after 9/11, they, you know, basically shut down a lot of stuff and I'd lost that job. It nearly killed me. And I didn't, you know, for weeks and weeks, I couldn't get out of a funk. I was so upset about it. I couldn't understand. And then I, you know, lost one of my, a dog that I absolutely adored. And I was in a funk for a month about it. And then I started listening to podcasts and go, oh, my God, I finally bonded. Those are things that made sense to me then because I bonded to that job. I actually did. That was, you know, something I bonded to. So when it when I lost it, it was devastating. And it was the same with the dog. But, you know, bonding to people is hard for me. You know, I have no problem saying it. And I think I said it on the previous podcast, but didn't quite understand it. But my father-in-law, wonderful man, lived near us for like his whole life that I knew him. He was a wonderful guy, super nice. And he just passed away one night real fast. I didn't cry. I didn't have any emotions over it. And I kind of learned about that when I read The Body Keeps the Score, the book. And it does. There is things that are in there that says, you know, we don't cry. We go to funerals and we don't cry and we're not happy at birthdays. I heard this. I read this in the book and I said, yeah, that's me. And they call that, it's a trauma that is stored in your body that you just don't feel. And in the book, it says, you know, you're not crying at a funeral and you kind of feel like a monster, like you don't care about anyone. You know, this is a whole last 4 years has been a, you know, self-discovery of finding out why I, basically why I tick and what I do. And maybe I can change it as far as that's concerned.
And I think for the audience, two things I really want you to share is what made you turn to alcohol instead of, say, therapy? And the other thing is, what do you credit or who do you credit for regaining your sobriety?
I'm sure it was just simple pride. You know, I'm, you know, it's ego and pride that I didn't need a therapist. You know, every time I heard somebody say it back then, I was just kind of, I would shrug that off real quick. Like, oh yeah, 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 whatever. You know, but I was drinking too. Drinking was easy. You know, I had done it before. I don't know why I started again, but yeah, it was definitely ego and probably the macho thing about not seeing a therapist. And, you know, that was kind of stupid as far as that was concerned. It was a fire hose, full blast of information coming at me from every angle. And it was also being connected. All of a sudden, you know, I hadn't gone into it, but I 2 months after I found my biological mother, I found my biological father who had passed away, and he had five children, which were my four brothers and a sister. And so I have all this family that I'm meeting for the first time and all these things, you know, that are going on, and I'm listening to the podcast. So I have just way too much information coming at me at 100 miles an hour. And I wish I had slowed the thing down. Basically, if you listen to all the experts, I did everything wrong. You know, I just jumped in feet first. I didn't do any research. I didn't do anything. I just said, hey, I'm here. And I can only imagine how bad I would have been if they started rejecting me. At least they were, everybody wanted to see me and whatnot, which was nice. I heard the podcast and my heart goes out to the people that have been rejected because it's got to be hard. I'll give credit to Haley Radke. The first one I found was Adoptees On. And I listened to all of them. I just binge listened to every one of them. And that's when I kept saying over and over again, that's me. That's what I did. You know, one after another, as far as that's concerned.
So your guidance would be not to binge on podcasts.
I wouldn't think so. But I would think also my guidance is if anybody's planning on searching or is in the process of searching, make sure you're ready. I sent you the list of all the podcasts I listened to, and I've been listening to, believe it or not, I listen to the ones now that are the DNA surprises, the ones that they're not adopted. You know, they just, their dad isn't their dad or whatever in the thing because of Ancestry and 23andMe. And it's all the things they're talking about, and those are very similar to adoption as far as those stories. When you find that stuff out, because they're searching for a biological father or something, every one of us, including me, says, I am profoundly changed for the rest of my life. It's not gonna go away. I'm in a 12-step program where one nice old lady came up to me afterwards because I was sharing about, you know, adoption. And she goes, when are you going to forget about that and let go? And I go, never.
Right. Well, I'm really glad you shared. I want to go back a little bit because I'm glad you shared about the binging, and it was like a fire hose, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, along with everything else, the reunion and all of that, because I don't think I've ever had a guest share that. And I can totally get it, where maybe it's time to back off, right? Maybe even put a book down or turn a podcast off when you're in the beginning, in the throes of reunion. Like, it could be very, as you said earlier, overwhelming and overstimulating. I know people who have gone to conferences, for example, or summits and felt overstimulated. Like, it's good, right? It's a good event. However, there's a lot coming at you, a lot of information, meeting a lot of people and so forth. So I appreciate you sharing that, because most people have shared that they binged, and I was one of those bingers. However, I do recall stepping back, you know, like saying, okay, maybe not so much right now. And also, I had been in a reunion for a while, so it wasn't the beginning. So I think that's a pretty powerful statement that you made about how you approached it.
Yeah. I mean, it's the whole thing, you know, it's overwhelming if you didn't have podcasts. I imagine if somebody who was searching back in the 1990s before there was podcasts and found their family, I'm sure they felt the same way. I was in the situation where I could just put my brain on overdrive. It was not a good thing. And the other thing that you hear over and over, and you know about this, is that, and it, you know, one of the things that bothered me was the secrets. You know, it was just like, wow, I was a secret. I was a secret in my maternal side. And then when I found the paternal side, somebody says, well, you better not share that information. We don't want to share that. And I finally, after about, I don't know, a year, I said, you know what? I'm done with secrets. It's been 59, 60 years now of secrets. And my favorite saying that people have said, and I share it with other adoptees sometimes online or, you know, in a group or something, I said, I did nothing wrong. People want to think that I did something wrong by reaching out. As an adoptee, you didn't do anything wrong. There's no reason you should feel guilty and you should keep a secret. You know, it just that bothers me when people say, oh yeah, don't tell this person about, you know, this part of your story. And it's like, no, I can't do that. And not anymore.
Yeah.
You know, it's not healthy. It's not healthy for me. Secrets are not healthy for anybody, to be honest.
But yeah.
That's what they say.
And I think that, because I want to go back to when we as adoptees pick up habits or pick up tools that are not necessarily in our best interest, it is typically a normal reaction or response to abnormal situations, right? And clearly a lot of our lives, lived experience, is atypical. Being separated from our family of origin and then trying to connect the dots or find the missing pieces well into adulthood, which for me was almost like approaching 50. And so we're like right there together trying to make sense of things. That's an atypical situation. And so I'm pretty sure the first time I heard about normal reactions, so I'm talking drinking, drugs, you name it, that we seem to represent higher in than non-adopted people, it's Dr. Gabor Mate, I believe yeah. I first yeah. heard say, yeah, it's just normal. Like, that's just normal. And yeah. he has that book, right? The Myth of Normal. So, right. yeah, it's just, it's logical for us to end up indulging in things. And as I talk to other adoptees who have struggled with substance abuse and relapses and regain sobriety, it's worth discussing what happened, like what happened to cause it, and also what happened to get back on the path of a healthier lifestyle. So what do you credit for being able to do that?
What happened was, is that I wasn't getting, I didn't feel like I was getting anywhere better. And so I said, okay, I'll find a therapist. And that was good. Let me say, I have a wall in my house. Some adoptees don't, but I do. I have a picture of myself, the five siblings on dad's side, my sister and brother on my mom's side, all together, you know, 8x10s on the wall. And they're wonderful pictures. And every time I looked at them, I had them for a couple of years, I would just shake my head. I didn't know what I was feeling when I looked at it. And when I went to the therapist, I started talking. She goes, whoa. And, you know, I start telling her things. And what I realized there was what I was repressing and dealing with was all the things that happened to me in childhood with my adoptive mom. She was the narcissistic savior. She was very abusive mentally. A lot of bad things went on, and they were pinwheeling in my head. I finally put it all down on paper, all the things that I kept thinking about, because there were so many bad and ugly situations with her and what she would do to me and my sisters and my dad. And, you know, and then there was things with my dad. And then one of the different therapists, I was going to a different one. She said, you should write a letter to your mom. And she has already passed away. And I sat down one day and I do the, you know, Siri thing. I talked to it and I said, well, this is a good time. And I had my list of all the things. It ended up being almost 5 pages when it was done. And I felt so much better. And what had happened was all the crap that happened when I was a kid that was back in the basement came roaring forward. You know, it's like, because you're thinking about what happened when you were a kid and adopted. And that was a big relief. That was a big stepping stone for me to be able to do that. And then I was able to forgive my adopted father because I realized, oh my God, the stuff he put up with her, because they stayed married their whole life. She was a big handful for everybody. Let's just put it that way. There was nothing good about it. That was on the road to, you know, road to recovery, I would say, you know, one of the stepping stones. And it was also allowed me to, you know, hear things more clearly, put things in, you know, now that once I did that, and I stopped drinking, I was able to look at all this stuff and go, okay, it happened to me. I can't change it, but I can share, you know, and maybe help someone who's dealing with it. But I also take things away that really stick with me. There was two things. I finally read The Primal Wound because everyone said it's rough. I didn't find it so much rough, but I did find one thing in there that was very interesting. And I wrote it down and it's my main, one of the main things of adoption for me is that, and you know, this, everyone says, oh, you were so lucky. You were chosen. You were loved so much. It's like that, you know, all that tripe. Now I look at it as tripe. I that's what I grew up on. And in The Primal Wound, it said, oh, you weren't chosen. You were the next baby in line. It just put clarity to it because it was, yes, my adopted mom and dad didn't choose me. I was just the next baby that was available at the Cradle Society. They would have taken any baby. And it was a really, you know, that made that whole chosen thing just be flushed down the toilet, basically. I mean, it wasn't that it was bad, but it gave me reason why not to, you know, dwell on it or worry about it. It was just, you know, okay, yeah, wasn't chosen, right? Keep in mind, I'm in contact with all my brothers and sisters, you know, my biological. They're nice. We don't have, you know, any kind of a deep relationship one way or another. We enjoy talking to each other and whatnot. But one lady said on a podcast, she said, how did she say it? And I actually write it down. She goes, DNA and genetics create people, but history builds family.
I like that. It was so true.
It's so true. It's so true. The final one, as far as that is hitting home, is my childhood friend until I was 15, which I kept in contact with my entire life, Doug. He lives up in Seattle. You know, Doug came down to Florida, and we went and visited with my mom and sister and brother on biological side, and we spent the day together, and Doug regaled them with all these stories when we were kids. And after we left, I found out they sat around and talked, and they said, wow, those guys had a great childhood. It was really nice for my biological mother to hear that. You know, it really made her happy to hear all about that. And it was good for me because every time I visited any of my biological family, they would talk about stories of who they grew up with and how it was like this and that. And it was just me. And this time it was, wow, see, I did exist before I met you. You know, it was almost like I was a ghost. And now I'm, you know, they go, they heard the stories from someone else, you know, which right. Really, it was fun. It was a great day.
That's good.
As far as that was concerned.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
As we prepare to wrap up, what would you have to say about the synchronicities? Because there were quite a few when we were together in 2021. Any more to add?
As it turns out, myself and my sister, who was adopted, went to the same pediatrician that at the time, my two biological brothers, we were all at the same pediatrician. We lived less than a mile apart from each other when I was adopted to my biological father. And so we could have been in the same doctor's office playing. I could have been playing with my brother when we were 1 year old in the doctor's office. And it was, you know, it was kind of neat, you know, but it also said, I guess it was good that I went to California, because otherwise we would have been in the same school and the same,
right.
we would have been neighbors. So, that was, you know, I mean, there is a lot of stuff, you know, that nature versus nurture really means something now, because there's a lot of nature in me from what I've found out over the years now through the, you know, meeting everyone and talking. I, you know, we're very similar on that. I will say it was because of you, and I don't know if it's synchronicity, but I finally got my original birth certificate.
Very good. Yeah.
It was rough for me because the only reason why is because my biological mother said she named me. And sure enough, when I got it, there was no name on it. It was just a last name, you know, first name, middle name, blank, you know, father was legally redacted in it, but it had my birth mother's name on it. So it was a disappointment because I was kind of hoping that it would have said, you know, she named me Daniel, and it would have been fun if it said Daniel on it. So,
right. But, and you know, the thing about those documents way back when, a birth mother could have said XYZ and they not put it on there. You know, like I know of an adoptee who is in reunion with his birth mom, and she looked at that original birth certificate, and it was plenty of things. She said, that's not what I said. That's not. Yeah. Like she.
Yeah.
And it really broke her heart that the things she wanted on there weren't on there.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of like your non-identifying paperwork. I mean, mine was fairly accurate. They're about 90% accurate. And my sister, who was adopted, she found her family, and, you know, hers was a complete fabrication. So that's a warning to people if they're looking at their non-identifying paperwork. It can be real or it can be fake, you know,
right.
That doesn't mean anything. So
not entirely the truth. Yes. Anything you wanted to say more about your paternal reunion?
It's been very nice. I was invited to the oldest brother, we're Irish twins. And his daughter was getting married, and my wife and I was invited, and we actually went. And that's where I got a picture with all, you know, the five brothers and sisters and myself together, which was really neat, and got to meet everyone. I got to meet his two sons there. And when I arrived, we got invited to the rehearsal dinner after the rehearsal, and we went over there. And as soon as I walked in, my brother, and it was so welcoming, my brother grabbed me, the oldest one, and he, for at least 45 minutes, dragged me around the room because there was a ton of people there because it was an, you know, out of state. Everybody came from two different areas. So all of his friends were there. And he came around. I want you to meet my new brother. he introduced me as his brother to everyone, all his friends, family, anybody he knew.
His two sons walked in,
and I looked at him and pointed at him, and I said, I know who you are. And he goes, and they smiled so big and came to get your big hug and said, we know who you are.
Oh, that's great.
The next generation down has no big problem with this.
They don't have the same hang-ups.
They think it's all very neat and very fun, and you know, it's exciting. And
right.
You know, for us that are involved in it, it's exciting as well as a lot of turmoil in your brain.
Yeah. So, well, congratulations.
Yeah. They've been extremely welcoming, the whole family. So, I created as much havoc in their life as the whole thing created in my life, you know? I mean, that's a big thing for, you know, a large family to go through, you know? So.
Well, Michael, congratulations on regaining your sobriety. And like you, I don't say half brother or half sibling. So that definitely resonates with
it
me.
It would be like saying my sister that I grew up with was adopted. I go, this is my adopted sister.
Right.
That's stupid, you know?
I know. Well, I just thank you for coming back to Once Upon a Time in Adoptee Land. And is there anything I didn't ask you that you want to share?
No, I gave you a big list of books that I've heard about and read, and the podcast I listen to, if you want to put it in show notes for anybody to do. But I appreciate your time and all of the podcasts you do and the effort. You know, I know it's a lot of effort to get these out. I hear about it all the time. And so I appreciate what you're doing. And best of luck to all the adoptees out there that are searching. I hope it goes well for you. So
thank you. Thank you for listening and taking the time to have this conversation. It's been great.
Thank you.
It is always a joy to hear from a guest who wants to come back on to revisit, reflect, and reveal more of what has come up since their initial Once Upon a Time with me. I often say that if you ask me the same question a year from now, my answer might be different. We are evolving creatures with each new discovery that comes our way. It is important for me to remain open to learning something new that can change what I once thought about my beginnings. Thank you, Michael, for being willing to chat with me almost at any given time about what's going on in your life. Though we haven't met in person yet, it feels like we sat down in a local coffee shop, perhaps in Chattanooga, the midway point between Nashville and Atlanta, at least a half a dozen times, and compared notes on relinquishment, adoption, and reunion. It's not a tall task for me to make my way to the ATL and see you face to face in the near future, and I look forward to it. To all the listeners, I hope through Michael's words, you are reminded to be gentle with yourself. Seek out the many resources that empower you while pacing yourself with self-care. And most importantly, knowing that you are not alone in your journey of more self-discovery. If you're an adoptee and would like to share your adoption journey, visit JenniferDianeGolston.com. If you like Once Upon a Time in Adoptee Land, leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Follow and or give, hopefully, a 5-star rating so others can find it too. During the course of your day, I trust you will tell at least one friend or someone who you believe might find value in it, because word of mouth is still the very best way for the show to grow. If you seek to be an ally of the adoption community, I hope you will consider making a monthly donation of at least $5 or a one-time amount that works for you at patreon.com/adopteeland. Thank you for being here.